This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Mara Candelaria Reardon is one of the Democratic Party candidates seeking Congressman Pete Visglaski's position in Washington, representing Northwest Indiana. She was at an Indivisible Northwest Indiana candidate forum in Griffith last week, and here is some of what she had to say at the event.
I just thought I would start out by just telling you a little bit about me and where I grew up. I grew up in East Chicago in Munster. My parents were very community-oriented. They instilled in us the importance of political activism from a very young age. They were very engaged in their community and active in their community. In the 1960s, they went to Washington, D.C. During the War on Poverty and built Resurrection City, the little shanty town outside the White House, to bring to light, you know, the plight of people that were living in poverty. In the 70s, it was the Equal Rights Amendment and the joined Cesar Chavez in the grape boycott. There was probably a whole decade of my life that I didn't eat grapes, and I would say, tell me again, Mommy, why I can't have those, you know? So, I mean, that's the kind of family that I grew up in. In the 80s and 90s, they fought really hard against the dumping of foreign steel that was really decimating our economy here in Northwest Indiana. My father was a safety engineer at the steel mill, and then he ended up being a probation officer later. My mother was a teacher and a labor leader. So, I mean, they always had a cause, and we learned from a very young age that we didn't only political activism and political service to our community wasn't just something that was encouraged. It was something that was expected of us. It was something that it was expected of us. And they also connected for us from when we were very small through their discussions and through the discussions at our dinner table. They connected to us policy and the way policy affects communities. And so that really was a very good gift for me, I believe, that my parents gave me, that I don't think a lot of people always connect, and especially lawmakers, they don't always connect the policies that they're advocating for to how they're going to affect the community. And we see that right now in public education and the proliferation of charter schools and voucher programs. And I worked for Congressman Visglaski for about 5 years in two different positions. I did casework on the front lines, helping people with, liaising with federal agencies on their behalf. And then I went on and got promoted to federal projects, and I worked on the federal projects and grants. So it was one of my biggest, legislative achievements, I think, to date was, and honors really, was working with Congressman Visglaski as a peer. I was working with him to finish the Little Calumet River Basin Flood Control Project, and we needed state dollars, the federal money Pete had gotten, and the project languished for lack of state dollars for over 30 years. And so one of my, you know, a big source of pride for me is being able to finish that project, working with Congressman Visglaski and doing my job at the state level and getting a $14 million appropriation to finish that project after the devastating flood that really hurt, you know, displaced 6,000 homes and businesses in Northwest Indiana, closed the highway down for 3 days. So we were able to secure, I was able to work with my colleagues across the aisle and convince 149 other people in the General Assembly why we needed $14 million to finish that project. And so that was a big deal for a sophomore legislator. You know, in 2010, I was like, or 2009, trying to secure those dollars. So as a lawmaker, I've worked most of my career in the fiscal arena. So I know that when I first got to the General Assembly, I wanted to work on education and healthcare and different areas. But I always knew that the connection was getting the resources to the agencies and the people that needed them. So I knew that it was more important to be on Ways and Means, and that's where I served most of my time, was on the Ways and Means Committee, making sure that the money was going into the right places and trying and working on the budgeting process. So I've concentrated most of my efforts in the fiscal arena and in resources for our communities, because all of those bills, I don't want to talk down to anybody, but all of those bills, if you have an education bill, the education bill goes through its committee of jurisdiction, and then it gets recommitted to Ways and Means. So it's a really great learning ground as well to figure out where all the dollars are spent and allocated in the state government. And so I got to work on education issues, but I got to see them from a fiscal perspective too. So, you know, that's really the gift of being on Ways and Means, is having that impact on, you know, if I hadn't been on Ways and Means when my community was devastated by flood, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, work to get those dollars to the right place. So what else can I tell you? I've got, you know, I've just been working really on, in 2018, I was elected by my peers to be the chair of the House Democrat Caucus. And so I'm currently in that position. And when I became the first Latina woman elected to a leadership post in Indiana, I had to step down from Ways and Means. Well, I didn't have to, but I felt I had to, in order to give somebody else an opportunity to come forward and learn about fiscal issues. So we put some freshman legislators on Ways and Means so they could, you know, learn all the things that I learned and take them back to their communities. So those are the things that, you know, that I've been doing and that I've been working on as a lawmaker. I believe that this job that I'm running for, this congressional district job, is a job that I've been preparing for my entire life. I believe that experience matters, and I've been working in a collaborative legislative environment for the past 12 years, and I want to take those skills and transfer them to Washington, D.C. I think that we can really make a difference for Northwest Indiana. So that's really just a little bit about me. I'm happy to answer questions that you might have. The whole healthcare issue. Well, that's a lot. So, I support a Medicare for All proposal that allows people a private option if they're happy with it. I think that there are some people that are happy with their insurance and they don't want to change. I think that when they have an opportunity to get the healthcare that they want, but I believe that everybody has to have access to healthcare. Everybody has to have access to health care. And that's why I believe the Medicare for All those that want it, I think, is a really good option for people. This is a chatty group normally. Why is everyone being so shy? Go ahead. Okay. Well, you lay it on me. I'll do my best to answer. I don't pretend to have all the answers, but.
So I have two boys that are going to be graduating soon, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on college tuition, student loan. Where are you at with all of that?
Well, I mean, I think that, first of all, I think that college has gotten out of control in pricing. There are classes that cost me $75 that now cost $375. It's absolutely incredible. And I think we really have to get a handle on that. I also believe that there are programs for loan forgiveness that are not working. And we need to figure out why they're not working, because there are existing programs for loan forgiveness. If you do public service, or you do different things, right? Teach in a rural area, or nobody can get loan forgiveness based on those. I think we really have to figure out why it's not working. And absolutely, I believe that there are areas that we need people to move to, that we need people to help other people. I think that it's a path by which people can go to college and not end up with a ton of debt. I'm still paying off student loans. I'm 55. So it's something that affects everybody. It's something that affects everybody. You see the unintended consequences of that. We often talk about that in the legislature. We talk about unintended consequences. And one of the unintended consequences of student loans are that home sales are down, right? Millennials are not buying homes because they're making a house payment for their college education. So it's a big issue.
From what you said, you've had a good view of what Congressman Husklowski has done over the years. How would you critique him in terms of what has he done really well? What would you do differently? What would you want to follow in his footsteps with? How do you see yourself as being different or the same?
Well, that's a great question. Congressman Husklowski has, I think he's done a very good job of trying to bring federal resources to our community. I think he, you know, has used his tenure in the legislature, you see the Marquette plan. You've seen things that have mattered there, that have been built. The double tracking, the South Shore double tracking, the South Shore expansion. Those are like generational projects. I think that he's done a very good job of bringing resources to the community. He's focused on defense appropriations throughout his career. I don't have an interest in defense necessarily. I have an interest in defense efficiency. I think there's a lot to be done in that area with regard to holding the defense area accountable for the dollars that they have and being more efficient with what they do have. And what else would I do differently? I mean, it's really hard to say until you're there. I mean, it's all based on your committee assignments and how you get along with other people and those relationships that you build. In my dream world, I would love to be able to work on things that matter to our community, bringing jobs, increasing. I believe in the entrepreneurial spirit of our community in the United States and being able to change what we've done. I mean, you've seen a whole economy grow around technology. I would love to see that around the environment and see the growth that can happen in that sector, because we really haven't invested and encouraged that sector very much. And in 2010, we voted to allow renewable energy generation credits in all sectors of energy. And right now the GOP has undone that. Why can't we have that be a federal mandate instead of allowing states to undo what we've already done? So in 2010, we did that. In 2017, the GOP undid it. The Democrats had control of the House in 2010. We passed this, and now they've undone it in 2017. So, I mean, I would like to work on growing an economy around energy efficiency and, you know. Yes.
You brought up two key areas that could possibly either butt up against each other or blend together. One of Congressman Husklowski's legacies is that he has been pro-union, pro-worker, in a sense, the average person. You know, this region has been hard hit, and you speak about entrepreneurial spirit and such. The fact is, there's going to either need to be job retraining, there's going to need to be some investment in our people so that we can
skill up,
maintain, and feed a family.
Sure.
Live, have a house, you know, live that American dream. And that's not happening in Northwest Indiana now as it did, and it was a given that would happen. And you're working in the state legislature, you've butted up against some issues, perhaps the right to work issue, which has reared its head in our state.
Common construction wage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but those things, I think, can the energy area, the environmental area, can be an area to try and work together in some of those things. Can you speak to that in some way?
Yeah, so I was just meeting with the steelworkers, Local 6787, and we were talking about just that, that there is going to be a shift, right? There's going to be a shift in industry, and I think that union labor has seen that coming, especially the steel workers, I will say. They have seen that coming, and they are looking to prepare for that. They're being proactive, and they're looking at, for example, they told me that they believe that that there's going to be a point in time where we have made all the steel that we need in the world, that they have to be ready to recycle what we already have and repurpose it for use in the things that we need to build with steel. And so I think that there is going to be that movement that is driven by labor itself, oftentimes, and hopefully incentivized and supported by the government to retrain workers. And there was a great idea that we talked about was carbon capture. The coal-fired power plants that are going to close, they would like to repurpose those into carbon capture and retrain their workforce to man those. So they're already thinking forward. They're you know, labor is forward thinking in their, they know that they have to change and modify the things that they're going to do if their workforce is to survive. And so those are the kinds of initiatives that we need to be supporting at the federal level. Absolutely.
So I have two questions. So mm-hmm. The first one's a state one. Mm-hmm. What's the work status on Street 45 in Munster? Because it's a lot of construction, and I've been late a few times for work. And the second one is, since grad students, we don't get Pell Grants. I'm lucky my tuition's $5,000 a year. So I can just take out a student loan for that, which I didn't have no choice but to.
Right.
So would you like propose legislation to increase, to allow graduate students like master's, PhDs to get Pell Grants, because we don't qualify for that?
So, you know, this is a perfect example of something that I don't know. And that's why I think one of the things that I love about being a lawmaker is exchanges like this and meetings like this, because some of the best legislation is actually identifying a need in the community and proposing a solution for that. And I think that's a great idea. So I'm going to steal it.
Okay. Because right now, like the maximum Pell Grant you can get is $5,500 a year. And it obviously goes by your FAFSA status.
Sure.
I qualified for a few times, but it was always like $500. I'm like, just take it away since I'm not going to get anything.
Right.
But with graduate school, they just, my financial aid is like, you don't qualify for that. You're not an undergrad. So the only thing they give you is a graduate assistantship if you get accepted to one, or you just got to.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, if we want to, you know, a lot of the union guys that I know actually have college degrees. They go to labor studies, or they studied something. They have college degrees, so it's not like there's not an educated workforce, right? So they still need to be retrained, and they might need graduate level work. And I think that's a really great idea. See, we're connecting those two. I like it. 45th. Let me tell you about 45th. So they are currently, you know, they're taking 45th and they're connecting it. Instead of that weird jag that is there now, they're going to connect it. But in order to do that, they have to take the railroad tracks off the tracks, the existing tracks, and move them onto a kind of a weird spur onto the street, so that the trains continue, those super federally protected trains. So while they're building the road, the train is still going to be able to pass through there on the road. Then they're going to move it back. It's crazy. And it's going to be 2 years. They could do it probably in half the time if the railroads didn't have so much power and they weren't so protected. It's adding to the cost and to the time.
Has the governor said anything about it?
The governor came out here to cut the ribbon. I mean, not cut the ribbon, but shovel the dirt or whatever they do there. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not really anything that we can do. They're so protected. Railroads are so federally protected that there's nothing the state can do. I mean, that, you know, it would be like saying, okay, well, let's shut down the railroad. If we shut it down for like 8 months, 9 months, it would be done, and it would be half the cost. But we have to make this spur for them to keep on keeping on that road line. So it's a challenge, but it's costing us a lot more money because of it. So, yeah.
And the question, follow-up question on that. Is it going to go underneath the tracks, or it is now still going to be a crossing that is going to cause traffic jams because you're going to...
It's still going to be a traffic jam.
Was it not initially?
Well, it was supposed to be an underpass.
Yes.
No, because that costs even more money. So I think the town made a decision. The town of Munster made a decision on which way to go. I think that it's crazy to me that they are not addressing the train track issue. And they're connecting 45th without addressing it. I don't know why that decision was made, but it was made by the town and the town council. So, I mean, it's still going to be a nightmare. There probably won't be a light there, though. There probably won't be a light there. So it'll be like the light will be on 45th, right? So where the speedway is. So, I mean, the town council has, like, the plans posted at the town hall, so you could check it out. But I think they should have gone with the underpass instead of that weird, you know. Because all we're doing is we're helping people from Illinois get across our roadways. We're not helping Indiana go north and south, right? We're just connecting Illinois people to cut through our community. The other thing I'll say about that is that, you know, I'm going to get a lot of grief for not supporting a bill to train teachers, because right now teachers are allowed to carry guns in schools. I don't know of any teachers that want that. And frankly, we're human beings. We make mistakes. Nobody is perfect. What happens, God forbid, if there is a student that takes the gun from the teacher's desk or purse or is bathroom, wherever? God forbid. And we expect a teacher to be able to teach all day long these kids, build relationships with kids. And then should the kid have some mental health issues and bring their dad's gun to school, we're going to require that same teacher who has built a relationship and educated this child for 9 months out of the year to shoot that kid? That's what we're expecting of teachers? I'm sorry. It's too much. It's absolutely too much.
Where do you stand on women's reproductive rights?
Well, I'm a woman, so I think that I'm the only one that can make the choice on what to do with my own body and my own health care.
Will you support repeal of the Hyde Amendment?
Yes, absolutely. I just think that this discussion has been going on for a long time. I mean, it's the same GOP attack on everything. It's the war on women. It's, you know, it's gays, guns, God, the environment. There's a handful of things that they like to have us focus on so that we're forgetting about the corporations that aren't paying any taxes. And, you know, those are the things, the shiny balls that they keep waving in the air, you know. And it's we've been chipping away at this for a long time. In this state, we've been requiring, we've had legislation to require women to be violated by probes in order to stop them from getting an abortion. We have voted to have surgical equipment required that is never to be used. Expensive surgical equipment. We have said your hallways have to be a certain width, surgical width, in an abortion clinic. And frankly, I don't understand the ire of people that oppose Planned Parenthood. What is wrong with Planning Parenthood? That is not the only thing that they do. They help women with regular health screenings on a sliding scale if they don't have money. They provide birth control so that they don't have unwanted pregnancies. People are human. People are flawed. Things are going to happen. You're going to make mistakes. We know that not everybody that gets pregnant wants to be pregnant. Sometimes it's rape or incest. What do we do in those cases? It's just not, and I don't see the affection that the GOP has for fetuses the same affection that they have for children. I don't see it reflected in the budgets they pass at the state level. I don't see it reflected in the opportunities provided for health care and jobs and child care. They don't need a pack of onesies and diapers from your church. They need jobs and health care, child care.
And that's Mara Candelaria Reardon, who's a state representative and a Democratic Party candidate for U.S. Congress. It's from her February 6th forum in Griffith. Her candidate forum lasted more than an hour. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This coming Saturday is 219 Day. What is 219 Day? Well, here's the lady who can tell us the most about it. Donna Muda is the special events coordinator for the city of Hammond, and she's joining us from Hammond City Hall to tell us a little bit more about, I guess, a way to celebrate the region. Hi, Donna. Thank you for joining us on the program today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, if you will, tell us a little bit about the origin of 219 Day.
The origin of 219 Day, it was the idea of Mayor McDermott to come up with a day that's a holiday for the 219 area code, because he saw on Twitter from Region Rant Rants, which is a bunch of people we think that maintain the Twitter account, that they suggested that the region should have a holiday. And we decided to do it. So we have it every year. This is our fifth year at the Hammond Civic Center. This year it will be on February 15th. Which is the closest day I could make it to 219, because 219 happens to be in the middle of the week.
Yeah. I'm sure that you're close to 219, too. That is February 19th,
I think next year it's Friday, so we can do it actually on 219 day. And we're going to have the event start from 6 to 11 p.m., and we hope everyone in the region can join us.
What kind of entertainment? I know it's billed as a place not only you have a chance to relax, be with friends, enjoy a little brew if you want to, some good food, and the entertainment, and the live entertainment I know is really the key, I'm sure, for a lot of people. Tell us about some of the places where you and the other members of the 219 Day Committee come up with the entertainment that, for example, is going to be in this year's program.
A lot of times what we do is get local area acts to perform at it, and we try to get a variety. So this year, you know, there's a lot of people on our committee, so they've either gone out and saw bands, or I also do Festival of the Lakes as part of my position. Mm-hmm. So I get a lot of artists submitting through the Festival of the Lakes, and sometimes I'm able to use one of those acts for the 219 Day. But this year we did a little bit different. We reached out to a Hammond police officer that has his own band. It's called One Timer. His name is Ben Stombaugh. He's going to be the opening act at around 6:30. And then the well-known act that's very high energy and really fun is Kojak and Company. They're from Hegwisch. And then we decided to do a Pearl Jam tribute that's mostly from Chicago. I think one of the guys is from the region, and they'll go on at about 9 o'clock. We felt that, given all the acts that were presented to us this year, the Pearl Jam tribute was a good one, because a couple of years ago we had the Back in Rat, where we had an AC/DC cover act, and it seemed to be what the public wanted more than anything, a little bit of a rocking good time.
Now, we should mention, as well as the free entertainment, there's going to be some interesting guests that are going to be on hand, and one in particular that that you mentioned is going to be there, I guess, and no doubt she'll probably be honored, I guess, because she's working for a very important title. Tell us about what is going to happen there.
Crystal Cagli, I'm going to mess it up, but I know, but I think it's Quagliaria. She's a Hammond resident. She right now is Mrs. South Shore, and she's going to be competing for Mrs. Indiana. So she, that comes up in April, so she wants to get to know her 219 public that are going to be able to vote for her to be Mrs. Indiana, and she's going to come to 219 Day this year, and she's willing to take selfies in the selfie booth, walk around and talk to people. Hopefully she'll be wearing her crown and her sash so people can differentiate who she is. She's a very beautiful woman, and I think well-representative of the 219 area code. So hopefully you can stop by and take a picture with her or shake her hand and talk to her a little bit about what she's all about.
One of the other things that we know, too, because it's not only 2020, it's a very important year here, at least in the United States. It's a very important year, I guess, over in China. Aside from the problems they're having with the virus over there, it's the year of the rat. And
yes.
You decided this year for 219 Day that you're going to honor that. Tell us what's going to happen on this coming Saturday.
Yeah, this is great. We're all region rats. Everybody knows that. And that's what 219 Day did. We got Reggie the Region Rat to be our mascot for the event. So we build our event every year around our little rat guy. And this year, he's a karate rat because of the Year of the Rat on the Chinese zodiac calendar, which only comes up every 10 years. So this is going to be really interesting. We've got some customized Chinese fortune cookies that are really cute little region things when you break open your cookie. We've got a lot of great Chinese things for our little guy. It's a pinata that we have custom made every year with his little outfit based on the theme. We have some Chinese lion dancers coming in. Everything built around Reggie the Region Rat being a karate guy this year. So it's really fun. When the events first started out, people weren't really liking the idea of marketing with a rat. But now that we've kind of softened his image a little and made it a little bit funnier over the years, it's really taken hold, especially with the public in the 219 area. I mean, I've had people just stop me when I'm out going out to eat or I'm out in public and say, if you ever get rid of the rat, I'll never come to it again. That's the best thing we've done. So we're really proud of Reggie, and we hope everybody likes him. He's actually going to be at the event. He'll be willing to take pictures with people as well. So that should be really fun.
Now, you have a committee that helps you on this presentation every year, over the 219 Day Committee. Do you get suggestions from folks that have attended past 219 Days on ideas for entertainment or other topics to bring up?
We do, and they usually contact us through the website, which is great. And the other way that they can send me messages, and they have done that, is we have these big boards when you come into the Civic Center. There's going to be four of them this year, big 4x8 signs, and they say, you know, you're from the region if, and people can write me notes on that. And some really cool things get written on that, some things we don't want to talk about,
well,
but a lot of
yeah.
cool things we do want to talk about. So we look at those, too, when we take them off the wall. So that's pretty cool. That's an interesting way. It's almost like graffiti, you know, for people to communicate with us. And also always through the website, which is 219day.com. There's a little email icon you can click on, and that'll come directly to me.
Now, since this is a day that basically covers the entire area code, so it's a pretty wide area, and you're encouraging mm-hmm. folks from Porter County and LaPorte County and other places that have a 219 area code ahead of their phone numbers to have a chance to come over on 219 Day, I understand you have a very special opportunity for folks that maybe want to catch the train to come over and then make their way back home. Tell us about that.
Yes, we want anyone from South Bend to Chicago and anywhere in between to come. It's for everybody. You don't have to be from the 219 because mm-hmm. we do have a lot of border communities that like to come as well. But we partner every year with the South Shore Line, and there's posters on the trains now inviting people to take the train, and we provide a shuttle bus from the Hammond station of the South Shore to the Civic Center and back for people that want to take the train and come and enjoy the evening with us.
And we've gotten the reaction to folks that attend, get to sign up on the big boards that are going to be up, especially this year over at the Civic Center, as they have all through the event. And they obviously get a chance to catch up with you at other special events probably in Hammond in the meantime, if they happen to have maybe couldn't think of anything at a particular time to sign the board. But they probably come back to you later and say, hey, here's something that might be interesting to add to the list of events, and you get to bring these up before the committee.
Yes, they can always get in contact me. They can call me here in my office at the Hammond Civic Center, or they can email me through my City of Hammond email, which is my last name and first initial, mutad@gohammond.com. My telephone number is 853-7708. That's my direct line. If I'm not in, because I'm in and out quite frequently, they can let me know what their opinions are on my voicemail, and we most certainly keep a list of everything and talk about it all throughout the year. So everything gets considered. One thing I did want to mention, Chris, that we're selling this year that we haven't in the past is a 219 baseball cap. We have our stocking cap with the little pom-pom on the top. Sometimes people, that's not their style. It says 219 on the brim, and it has the region on it. But the baseball cap is a black cap with white 219, and sometimes people like to just have a baseball cap, and we're going to sell those this year. at the event for $15 each. Those are only available at the event. So if you want to come and check those out, there should be pictures of them up online on GoHammond.com. Just click on the little karate rat when you get to GoHammond, and page down to the bottom, it'll show you everything we're selling. We have a new version of the T-shirt this year, both styles of the hat right there. So you can get those at 219day.com.
Now, Donna, how much work ahead of time has had to be planned working with the folks not only that take care of the Hammond Civic Center, where it's going to be, of course, this year, but other venues around the city that have participated in 219 days in the past? How much advance work do you have to do to get ready for these events?
I typically start working on this. Normally, I have the Hammond Holiday Parade in early December, and then I take some vacation time at the end of December. But when I get back to work right in the 1st of January, we start working on it. So sometimes in November and December, between my two big parades, I'm already sending out things to people about Let's Meet and out to my sponsors, so they have time to make arrangements to sponsor the event, should they like to. So it takes several months the previous year, because this is in February, so a good 4 to 5 months ahead of time is when we start meeting on this event.
Well, Donna, thank you for spending time going over the event list itinerary for this coming Saturday's annual 219 Day. It'll be the fifth annual 219 Day, we should mention, in the city of Hammond. And we thank you for and sharing some of this with us, some of the interesting events, special events that are going to be going on this year, besides the fun and the weirdness and the wackiness that this seems that this often always to bring every single year that celebrates everything Regent. Thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me. A wonderful day.
Thank you. We're talking with Donna Muta, who is her official title is that of Special Events Coordinator. And this is definitely a special event for the city of Hammond about the upcoming 219 Day, which is going to happen this coming Saturday. And it'll happen from 6 a.m. until 11 p.m. At the Civic Center, which is located in Hammond. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Erosion is threatening communities in northwest Indiana as well as along the Chicago lakefront. Residents and officials say that the situation is being made worse by their state's inaction. Reporter Michael Puente went on a tour of the affected area along the lake, and he has this report.
It's been a busy new year for Jeff Benson. As president of the Beverly Shores Town Council, erosion is an issue he faces daily. Benson has been spending most of his time shoring up vulnerable sections of the town's lakefront. He explains there are some spots where very little stands between the lake and people's homes.
The cement wall that had been there had collapsed into the lake. Look how close it is to the road.
Benson has been trying to come up with solutions from keeping an ever-rising Lake Michigan from washing away the town's sandy dunes. It's already swallowed up a small section of Lakefront Drive, which hugs the shoreline.
So did you have to shut down the road?
Not yet. We've reduced the speed limit and asking people to not be here. But right in front of you it's cordoned off.
Yeah.
And if we just kept going, then the road's in the lake. It's gone.
Benson says some homes are at risk of damage or being lost, but that's not all.
What we're really worried about here in Beverly Shores is under our road is gas lines and water lines. Sand erodes so quickly, and if the road goes in, the gas line goes in, ruptures, and we got a real problem on our hands.
In late December, volunteers worked feverishly to rebuild a 100-foot section of rocks called revetment that the lake had earlier eroded and exposed a small section of earth and tree roots. The revetment is to protect the nearby road and an area that is a popular spot for tourists since it's surrounded by the Indiana Dunes National Park.
It was very dangerous because the areas around it were hardened structures and it was an open slot exposed to 300 miles of lake with the waves going right into our sand dunes that with no revetment, and it would erode very, very quickly.
The town spent $300,000 of its own money to do the work, but now there's not much left for anything else. It went looking for more from the state of Indiana, but was turned away, even after the county it's in, Porter County, declared a state of emergency. WBEZ reached out multiple times to the state's governor, Eric Holcomb, for comment, but were turned down or asked to speak to the state's Department of Homeland Security. There are multiple structures threatened by the pounding waves, including five homes that were part of the Century of Progress World's Fair in Chicago in 1933. The homes, including a pink Floridian-style home, were moved to Beverly Shores from Chicago 87 years ago.
And I would say it's the most valuable real estate in the whole state of Indiana that is on the brink of falling in.
This worry isn't exclusive to Beverly Shores. Just down the road, Portage is dealing with its own erosion issues.
Well, I was out there. The wind was fierce again and just beating the shoreline to death.
Sue Lynch is the mayor of Portage. She's worried about a $17 million lakefront pavilion, a major draw for tourists that also lies within the Indiana Dunes National Park.
I do expect the lake levels to rise, and I just expect that more homes and the potentially that beautiful building out there will be in peril.
Lynch is dumbfounded by the lack of response from the state. Porter County, which houses both communities, was turned down by Indiana's Department of Homeland Security because there hasn't been enough damage at this point, though they have promised they would work with officials to come up with short-term solutions, but they've been light on specifics. The state also won't help pay for a $1.6 million shoreline study by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps says it would cover half the cost.
I don't think they hear our voice up here, and that's kind of historically the problem that Northwest Indiana's had. I mean, money from our industries goes down to support our state, but nothing of consequence comes back up here.
So for now, it's a waiting game between seeing action from state lawmakers or further damage from Mother Nature. I'm Michael Puente.
Those are the four most recognizable musical notes in the world, and a few more, but you get the point. We have Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, among many others that are going to be heard for the very special concert coming up at the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra on March 6th. And with us to talk about it, we have Maestro Kirk Muspratt, who will be up there with the baton in front of the entire orchestra with a great evening of music of Vivaldi, Rachmaninoff, and Beethoven.
Yes. Thank you, Chris. Hello, everyone. I'm looking forward to this program very much because the Vivaldi Four Seasons, which you've asked me for many, many times, is programmed. It's one of your favorite pieces, and we all love it and know it in the world. It was written in 1716, a little while ago, in the Baroque era, and the red-headed priest, Vivaldi, wrote it, the first piece of program music, where it wasn't just notes in G major. It was about shepherds and dogs barking and mosquitoes buzzing and ice and wind and thunderstorms, all in 1716 for the very first time.
Well, it had to be quite an event to happen for the people that heard it for the very first time.
Yes, the people in the Venetians, when they heard it, they thought he was absolutely crazy. And actually, he had a lot of trouble at the school while he was composing this new kind of music.
Wow. Yeah. Now, besides Vivaldi, we mentioned we have a Rachmaninoff on the program for the evening. That's going to be, by the way, on March 6th at 7:30 in the evening. And of course, tell us about the venue. That's always a nice place to check out.
It is. It's a lovely Living Hope Auditorium is our new home. It's very intimate. It's very warm. It's inviting. The acoustics are wonderful. The sight lines are terrific. And it's a great place to watch the soloists. You mentioned that there's Rachmaninoff on program, Chris.
No.
So we're having Yana Resnick come back and be our soloist. She's a fantastic Russian pianist who now lives in Chicago and plays with all of the CSO, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra members regularly, chamber music. And this is a beautiful, gorgeous, if you like Rachmaninoff, piece of music that we have actually never played for some reason, at least while I've been here. And it was written by Rachmaninoff when he's 18 years old. And you can't believe how difficult it was. He was a great virtuoso, really beautiful piece.
Now, of course, we started off our conversation with a little bit of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and that's one of the highlights of the program that evening, I understand.
It is, yes. So again, another groundbreaking piece written in 1808 by Beethoven. And he broke all the rules. He broke every rule in the book. It's like going to a hockey game and they play it with a basketball or something. He just like, no, I'm breaking all the rules. And I'm looking forward to, it's his 250th birthday.
Of course.
We have to do a birthday piece.
That's right. Yeah. Now, tell us, first off, how folks can get tickets for the March 6th the concert that's going to happen in Crown Point / Merrillville, and where they can find the tickets.
Sure. Just call the office. It's 219-836-0525. And just ask for Nancy or Tammy, and they will help you. Or go on our website, you know, for NISOOrchestra.org, and you can get them there. Also, I should mention, Chris, I hope everyone will come to the pre-concert talk. We have a pre-concert talk from 6:15 until 7, and we have lots of fun, and we have lots of questions and answers back and forth. So come early, and I look forward to visiting with you.
Well, it sounds like a great evening of music coming up on Friday, March 6th with the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. And thank you, Kirk, for all the information and the best of luck on that show.
Thank you very much,
Chris. That's Kirk Muspratt, who's the musical director and the conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. Time once again for Eye on the Arts. And here's Micah Bornstein with South Shore Arts filling in for John Kane.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm Micah Bornstein. I'm filling in for John Kane, and I'd like to thank everybody for joining us for another edition of Eye on the Arts. I'm here today with Peter Oglinskis.
Yes, hi, Micah.
How are you, Peter?
I'm great, thank you.
Well, Peter, I'd like to thank you for joining us on this, my first hosting of Eye on the Arts, and I know you're here to talk a little bit about Thursday Night Noir. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, and welcome, Micah. I'm proud to be on the maiden voyage here. Thursday Night Noir is an event based on my film lecture series, Noir Style and Image, Word, and Sound. It takes place every third Thursday of the month, January through April, at the Brouwer Museum of Art in the Center for the Arts building on the campus of Valparaiso University. The film screen at 7 p.m., then we take a short break after the film and reconvene for a lecture discussion that I present with projected still images to enhance the presentation, and then we usually have a very lively discussion afterwards.
So it's not just a film screening, it's a bit of an educational event.
Yes, I like to call it the perfect fusion of scholarship and entertainment.
That's great. And how is this a new thing? Has this been going on for a while?
Actually, we've been doing this for quite a while. This will be our sixth season. We've developed quite a following, and I have to hand it to the director of the museum, Greg Herzlieb, for taking a leap of faith a solid 7 years ago, and it's been going strong ever since.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. I do love the Brouwer Museum. I haven't been for a little while, but it's a beautiful arts venue here in Northwest Indiana.
It is a real gem.
And you said you've developed a healthy following. How many people would you say come to one of these events?
Well, I would say we have about 50 regulars, and the attendance can go upwards towards 100.
Wow.
Yeah, we get a good crowd.
And does it cost anything?
Actually, no, there's no admission charge. The events are free, and the museum even provides free popcorn and bottled waters. Parking is free as well, but I have to let people know that they've changed the parking layout about a year and a half ago. So if you haven't been there in a while, Micah, I strongly suggest to you and everybody listening to go to the university's website to get a lay of the land if you haven't ever been to the museum or if you haven't been there in a while. Especially during the winter months, you want to give yourself enough time to park, get settled, and catch the films from the beginning.
And speaking of the films, what films are there? Do you have a lineup? Do you have anything you're excited about?
Oh, yeah. We have a wonderful lineup for the rest of this season. We had a wonderful turnout for the first film in January. It was 1946's Decoy. And in fact, I want to thank Lakeshore Public TV's Justin Hill and Tony Santucci for coming out to film the whole event, which is going to be on your Eye on the Arts television program. I believe it's going to air this spring. So I wanted to keep people's eyes open for that. Our next offering will be February 20th, DOA. is a 1950 film starring noir staple Edmund O'Brien. It's a hapless schmo on a heated rampage in San Francisco and L.A. to find the killer of, himself. It also features a delightfully psychotic performance by frequent noir heavy Neville Brand. It's directed by Rudolf Matte and based on the 1931 German film Der Mann, der seine Mörder sucht, which was directed by Robert Siodmak. And he went on to direct such classic noirs as Phantom Lady and Criss Cross, both of which we have featured in earlier Thursday night seasons. So the noir pedigree in this film is very strong. March 19th, we're going to feature Private Hell 36 from 1954. It's a classic crooked cop film. It's a prevalent film and theme in film noir, which, unlike gangster films of the 1930s, blurs the lines between good and evil, cop and criminal. It stars Ida Lupino as the sexy nightclub singer who inspires all of this Misha Gass and Steve Cochran and Howard Duff as the two cops at the center of the conflict. It's directed by Don Siegel, who you might know as the director of the Dirty Harry franchises. And April 16th, we feature The Burglar from 1957. It's a heist film, another prevalent film noir theme, and stars noir staple Dan Duryea and his stepsister, played by none other than a very young Jane Mansfield. It's based on a novel by hard-boiled writer David Goodis, who also wrote Dark Passage, which was turned into a great classic film noir. And he also wrote the novel Dark Passage, which was turned into a great film noir as well. Well,
Peter, that is a very exciting lineup, and I can tell you're passionate about these films, and I'm sure that the discussion afterwards is lively and fun as well.
Yeah, we have a great time, and sometimes if the crowd is active enough, I get to work the room like Phil Donham here with a remote mic.
Well, Peter, thanks for coming by, and I wish you well, and I'll hop out there and catch one of these films. Thank
you. We'd love to have you. Thank you, Micah.
You can hear more Eye on the Arts conversations like this one at our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Back with you tomorrow.